7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. That Brian Edwards Teeker is not used to being in the studio with him anymore.
You go away for 4 weeks.
My bad.
We're going to start with international news this morning. The big news to hit the wire was that Iran has crossed one of the thresholds that was in the nuclear deal that the Trump administration abruptly pulled out of. And that threshold is enriching uranium past the 4.5% mark. Now, it's still a long distance from what uranium needs to be considered weapons grade. That is 90% enriched uranium. But it is an escalation. And there's some questions about whether it narrows the span of time between where Iran is and where it would need to be to assemble a nuclear weapon. The threshold of concern here is apparently a one-year window to nuclear weapons capability. We're joined now by Leonard Spector. He's deputy director of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. He formerly served as Assistant Deputy Administrator for Arms Control and Nonproliferation at the National Nuclear Security Administration. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why don't you start with the actual technical significance of Iran starting to enrich uranium to a greater concentration?
Well, the technical significance of this particular adjustment is not very great. It is definitely a violation of the terms of the agreement. So I think it's much more significant politically and in terms of what might come next than this actual step itself. And it looks as if, at least for the moment, the Iranians are being pretty cautious because if they bump up to, let's say, 20% enrichment from 4.5%, then they're getting into an area where it really would shorten the time that might be needed to develop a nuclear weapon.
You described it as breaking the agreement, and this is terminology and news coverage that has confused me. Wasn't the agreement already broken when the Trump administration reimposed sanctions on Iran?
Well, you might say that. I would say the Iranians didn't respond that way. They believed that because the other participants in the agreement, Russia, China, the UK, France, and Germany, because they were still in the agreement and they were prepared to continue with lifting of sanctions and trying to do some economic activities with Iran that had been previously prohibited, they were satisfied that they could continue with the status quo. In other words, they were not ready to say that the United States had broken the agreement and therefore all bets are off. But that is clearly changing, although not too dramatically just yet.
What is causing that change, the shift in reaction?
Well, I think the U.S. sanctions do have cast a long shadow, and I think they're beginning to hurt the Iranians very significantly. Their currency value is diminished by two-thirds, oil exports are way down, and the economy is really taking a hit because U.S. sanctions not only prohibit certain activities with Iran, but any party that would facilitate such an activity, such as a foreign bank or a foreign corporation, they can be sanctioned. And that's made the Europeans especially very cautious about continuing economic activities with the Iranians. And it's in that context, as these pressures are mounting on Iran, that I think they've decided they need to push back a little bit. But so far, at least, it's a very cautious pushback, and I think they don't want to just bring the whole agreement down.
What is the role of some of the other countries you talked about, and specifically, I guess, China? I mean, China has come straight out and said that, you know, this is the U.S. United States' fault in terms of its attempt to bully Iran into doing as it says.
Well, I think China is playing I don't mean to be negative here. They're trying to avoid a collapse of the deal and avoid an outright a violation of American sanctions. So one sanction that's very relevant is we prohibit other countries from purchasing Iranian crude oil. We tend to give them a break, however, if they significantly reduce their purchases of Iranian crude oil, and China has reduced, although the Trump administration says that may not be enough. We want zero purchases. But so China is part of the pressure, actually, on Iran, on the one hand, even though they do wish to see the deal remain intact, you know, as best it can.
Iran says still says it has no interest in developing nuclear weapons. My understanding is this enrichment threshold makes the fuel usable in the one nuclear power plant that the country has. Is it possible that they would not be expanding their stockpile of low-enriched uranium and increasing its enriched level were it not for the saber rattling for the United States, that this is purely a question of political leverage?
I'd have to say there is some pushback against what the United States is trying to accomplish. And, we were fairly lucky, I would say, that for a year, they more or less adhered to the deal completely, and they were found to be adhering to it by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And now, as the American pressure is mounting, there is this response. So I think it's correct to say that pressure started with us, and the Iranians now are looking for a way, I think, to respond without taking things too far, at least as yet.
It keeps coming up in coverage, this question of a one-year breakout window, how long it would take Iran to go from where it is now to being nuclear weapons capable. Can you explain what that window actually entails? Does it mean they have a nuclear-armed bomb or missile?
It would be the first nuclear weapon, an intact, ready-to-use nuclear device, hypothetically mounted on a missile, but that may not quite be something they can do at the moment, but certainly deliverable by other means. And what has to happen is you have to take the uranium that you've got to move it up to the weapons grade level, and then you've got to change that's a gas at that point. So it has to be made into metal, it has to be shaped, it has to be included into the weapon, the other parts of the bomb that you might have at the ready, and then you would be, in a sense, all set to go. What the deal has done is it put all these blocks before the weapon-grade uranium could possibly be made. It kept the stocks of what might be upgraded very limited. That's the stockpile. And it made it sort of impossible to go from where we are at the moment to the bomb in less than a year. And the thought was that gives the international community a time to crank up sanctions or take any other non-military measures that might pressure Iran to reverse course, or if worst came to the worst, that year's time would provide the opportunity for military intervention, and that would sort of be another check on Iran. I mean, the threat of that. So the year really has a lot of significance, and it is the main achievement, I would say, of the Iran deal.
So now that Iran is taking off some of those breaks, it's broken the 300-kilogram stockpile limit on low-enriched uranium. It's now breaking the 4.5% enrichment threshold. What is the best publicly available guess on how many months away it is from being capable of producing a nuclear explosion?
I would say it's still a year. The changes are very incremental at this point, but there's talk about upgrading uranium to a higher level, an intermediate level, which would make it much faster to get all the way home if they had to. It talk about enlarging the stockpile, and that would be very critical because the material, they would have then enough material to upgrade for a bomb. They wouldn't have that currently. This is the danger. Where we are at the moment, it's more of a political signal and a threat as to what might come next. And I'd say people seem to be taking it fairly seriously, although, the Iranians also seem to be playing very cautiously themselves.
People seem to be taking it seriously, yet the European countries that Iran is irritated at aren't really responding very well or quickly.
Well, that's true, but it's difficult for them. You take a company, let us say, like Airbus Industries. If Airbus Industries continued with what had been an arrangement to begin selling commercial aircraft to Iran, they would have been frozen out of the U.S. market. And so they had to make a business choice, and they chose to withdraw from business in Iran and a lot of other businesses, especially multilateral corporations that do business with us in particular. have to think very carefully as to whether they're going to risk losing the U.S. market. And if that hesitation, I think, even if the companies haven't made an absolute decision, you know, to stop all dealings with Iran, it's a go slow situation. And so the benefits to Iran of having the deal in place are much less than what they anticipated.
So where am I going? Donald Trump is probably going to continue to be Donald Trump, right? And want to make Iran pay, and threaten these other countries in terms of, you know, them violating the sanctions. Then how close do you see this turning into an open conflict?
Well, I think we have to watch the calendar. You know, if they keep raising the enrichment rate, you know, at like 1% a month, you know, well, even at that low rate, you know, by the time of the election, when Mr. Trump may no longer be president, you know, they will have gone, you know, into a dangerous zone on the Iranian side. So it may be, however, that they are appreciative of the election and the possibilities for a more moderate U.S. policy, and that they want to, you know, make their concerns clear by violating the agreement, but keeping it limited enough so that the deal would still be largely intact when a next administration might come in. So that may be part of the thinking. Of course, if Mr. Trump is reelected, then they have to deal with, you know, even more pressure from the United States and conceivably the risk of some kind of military action if they continue to go against the rules and the agreement. So it's, you know, the who's in power in the United States matters, but it's not, you know, we're not going to have a possible change, you know, for what, 18 months or so.
Well, let's talk about that hypothetical change. If there's a Democratic administration being sworn in the early days of 2021, and they want to return to the nuclear development control regime that was put in place under the Obama administration, is it a problem that Iran has now exceeded both the stockpile and the enrichment limits that were in that deal? It's not like the old deal can just go back into effect, can it?
Well, actually, it could go back into effect. I mean, that's another dimension of what the Iranians have done. If they built up the stockpile from 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium, let's say it's going to go up to 400 kilograms, it's very easy to reduce that, either by diluting some of the material or by sending it to a foreign country, which is one of the original plans. If you have more centrifuges enriching uranium than what's permitted in the agreement, you can stop those centrifuges. And the enrichment level the same way. You can go back to the pre-existing arrangements. The question is, I think, once the United States has imposed sanctions because of other behavior of Iran, interventions in Syria and in support for Hezbollah and for Hamas and for militias in Iraq, and intervention and support for the Houthis in Yemen, it may be difficult even for a Democratic president to simply say, well, we're going to put those issues aside again and we're going to go back to where we were and we'll make this deal work and we'll deal with those other problems, you know, separately. I think it's hard to reverse that part. From the American side, I think more than it would be difficult for the Iranians to simply restore the status quo under the deal. That's a mechanical thing that could be done, you know, pretty easily, and it would be under inspection, so you'd have verification that they'd actually done it. I think we're the ones that are going to have a greater problem, and I don't expect that any of the Democratic candidates will immediately, you know, as part of the platform, say, oh, we're going to lift all the sanctions on Iran, because I think that would expose them to criticism from Donald Trump. So, you know, this is more complicated than just the mechanical part of getting the deal back to where it was.
They probably can't talk about lifting sanctions on Iran, but they could talk about the ways in which he's worsened this crisis and put people at risk. That was more of a
absolutely
cop, right.
And they can certainly say they want to reexamine this. These policies don't seem to be working. There's a danger here that the population of Iran is suffering. I mean, there are plenty of things to say about this.
And this is our second nuclear sort of scary time in the Trump administration, right? We went from the wall coming down and us feeling relatively safer to this.
Well, this is quite dangerous, but North Korea, you know, is another problem, which I know we won't be talking about this morning. But it's actually more of a physical danger to the United States because they actually have nuclear weapons. What was so important about the Iran arrangement and trying to preserve it in some fashion is that it prevented Iran from going over that threshold. And so I'd say the situation right now is quite fragile, but certainly it would be an important American interest to see that Iran never gets to the stage of having, you know, a real nuclear arsenal the way North Korea has managed to do.
Well, Leonard Spector, let's take a minute to think about, like, how this looks from Iran's point of view, kind of what lessons there are from previous United States stances towards aspirational nuclear powers. Iraq gave up its nuclear weapons development program. We invaded, overthrew their government, and
destroyed their country.
Basically destroyed their country. Libya gave up its nuclear weapons program. We contributed to the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi and his assassination by airstrike. North Korea actually did develop and deploy nuclear weapons, and they're having diplomatic breakthroughs with President Donald Trump, who's crossing the border into North Korea and glad-handing Kim Jong-un. Isn't the lesson for any power, if you're close to getting nukes, get them quick, because then you're safe?
That is certainly one dimension of the problem. And it appears that Iran made a different choice, that it was attempting to get to a point of, or was satisfied, let us say, under the deal, of the world knowing it has the capacity to make nuclear weapons if it chooses to, and then showing some restraint, getting sanctions relief, staying within the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and trying to, you know, demonstrate a degree of responsible behavior to the world at large. I think, in a sense, they sort of optimized, because having enriched, as they have done, and gone to the 20% level, which they are not doing anymore but could go back to, with the demonstration of how many centrifuges they could manufacture and operate and all the rest, and now with some of this other information that's come out about how far along they were in designing a nuclear weapon, they have a sort of a deterrent in waiting. And at least at a certain point, they may find that to be sufficient. They've established this as far as the international community is concerned, and maybe they can achieve what they need in terms of protecting the country without that one extra step, unless some dire crisis arose, and then they could move in that direction. So there is a bit of a lesson, that's true, but the the Iranians appear to have taken a different tack.
You said what we're now learning about their nuclear weapons designs. Assume we haven't been reading all the stories you have. What do you mean?
Well, it's long been assumed, I'd say, by a lot of us that have been watching this, and the United States government and others, that there was a genuine, organized, aggressive effort to develop nuclear weapons in Iran. It was kind of, it paused some of the most clear-cut activities that were designing the weapon and testing out the non-nuclear parts appeared to have stopped in 2003. This is just at the time that American troops were in Iraq, and it could have been anxiety about the possibility that the United States might take military action against Iran. But for whatever reason, that seems to have been on pause. But now we have much more detailed information by virtue of this archive that the Israelis removed from Iran. It shows that this was not just, people scratching their head and wondering how we build the bomb. They were actually, they had four different designs or five different designs. They had mechanisms for doing cold testing. In other words, you'd assemble the bomb except for the nuclear stuff and see if it would go off just the right way. And there was, a tremendous amount of effort and accomplishment in that part of the weapons program. So I think we've got much more detail now than we had previously, although the general contours were pretty well understood.
But again, this is all as of 2003.
That's correct. But the program, as the archive shows, didn't simply stop dead. Elements, you know, research on this part went over to one university. Research on that part went to another research institute. And so elements of the program continued. What was known already, what was achieved, you know, was not, it didn't disappear. That still remained, you know, the knowledge and the technology and the tacit knowledge, the, you know, the sort of know-how that you gain by actually working with some of these materials and designing explosives and so on, all of that, you know, remains, you know, embedded in the scientific cadres that worked on this previously and can be restored, you know, if the time comes when it's needed. Now, they don't have, hypothetically, some of those materials because they may have been physically, you know, removed, and there may not be copies of some of this. But even so, you know, a lot happened, and it won't go away.
We only have about 45 seconds left, but I was just at the Hiroshima Memorial Center, and so we know that, like, no nuclear bomb is a good nuclear bomb, but what are we talking about in terms of its impact, the gravity of what they're capable of creating?
Well, in principle, you know, if they were to build a number of nuclear weapons, and they certainly have missiles that can reach Israel, that can reach, you know, Turkey, other places in the region, they would be, you know, become a nuclear power, and they'd have the ability to devastate other states in the region, although, of course, there would be possible retaliation by the United States on behalf of friendly states, or, of course, Israel has a certain capability as well. So you might get into a deterrence relationship. But all of a sudden, what would normally be, you know, some kind of a shooting war with conventional weapons suddenly takes on this potential for catastrophe.
All right. Leonard Spector, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Leonard Spector is Deputy Director of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies' James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. That is a mouthful. Formerly, he's Assistant Deputy Administrator for Arms Control and Nonproliferation at the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is another mouthful when you heard him refer to capabilities that Israel has as well. Israel is widely understood to have its own nuclear arsenal, but has never publicly acknowledged its existence. That takes us to 7:31 in the morning. The program's Up Front. My name's Brian Edwards-Teeger.
And I'm Kat Brooks.
Coming up next, wildfires. Specifically, what happens to power plants, power companies, and public utilities when their equipment leads to conflagrations that cause billions of dollars in damage. The state, very late in the legislative game, gutted and amended a ton of language into a bill. This is the Friday after July 4th. That is the governor's preferred package for stabilizing the wildfire liability regime. The process of negotiating this has been fraught with allegations that it could be a bailout for power companies, and also calls that the state needs to do something to avoid just destabilizing our entire power sector. We're going to get a take from Mark Toney, the executive director of the Utility Reform Network, who's up in Sacramento lobbying furiously even as I speak. That's coming up next.
After the news.